Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting the film series Testigo Witness, Goya in the Movies. Held on select Fridays in May, each film touches upon artist Francisco de Goya's visions of the world, kicking off with Pan's Labyrinth by Guillermo del Toro on May 10th at NortonSimon.org.
You have the chance to win a spring super sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. A number of the D.C.-focused political issues just talked about on the NBR Hourly News will be our focus coming up next hour on Air Talk. We'll have the very latest on the competing infrastructure plans. We'll talk about an investigation into the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol and other major issues that the House and the Senate are taking up. But I want to begin today's program by expressing my deepest congratulations and appreciation to KPECC's A. Martinez, who after a national search has been appointed host of NPR's Morning Edition and Up First. He joins Rachel Martin, Noel King, and Steve Inskeep in the lineup of Morning Edition. It's our loss in a way here at KPCC, just for having A in the building as a colleague and such a good friend. I love working with A and getting to know him over these years here at KPCC. I'm really going to miss that, but I'll love being able to wake up, hear him on Morning Edition, and know that listeners all across the United States are now going to have the opportunity to hear A's talents, his warmth, his empathy, his intelligence coming out of their speakers and their phones all across the United States. So it's wonderful news. His first day on Morning Edition nationally will be July 6th. He'll be working out of the NPR West facility in Culver City. So good news that A doesn't have to relocate either. NPR Vice President for News Programming Sarah Gilbert in NPR's release this morning that we're delighted to have A join the Morning Edition team, anchoring from NPR West. He brings a remarkable record of journalism and empathy that allows him to truly connect with audiences and stories. He brings intelligence, a sense of humor, and a deep curiosity that will fit right in with the show's commitment to telling distinctive stories that make a difference to our understanding of the world. And A noted in the NPR release, 9 years ago, I'd never listened to public radio. I was about to start a new path that would change my career and, in a deeper way, my perspective on life. The time I've spent at KPCC proves that public radio journalism can be accessible, relatable, and understandable to anyone, regardless of their background or educational pedigree. I'm excited to bring every experience I've had along the way to NPR and to represent Los Angeles and California the best way I can. And that will be a terrific way that A does that. A, we wish you all the best. And I hope you can be part of our triple play going forward and still be locally here on KPCC from time to time as you're hosting Morning Edition nationally from NPR West. Plans for a new program, post-A on Take Two, a new local program, will be announced at a forthcoming date. But we're just very, very excited for A and for the terrific choice that NPR has made. We begin on our update on COVID-19 today with Dr. Dean Blumberg, who's professor of medicine, chief of pediatric infectious diseases at UC Davis Children's Hospital. By looking at where we sit here in California, the continuing very good news. Thank you so much, Dr. Blumberg, for joining us. Your thoughts as we head into what appears to be a very heavily traveled Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah, well, I'd just like to echo congratulations to A. Martinez. I've spoken with him on Take Two. He's a pleasure to speak with, and it just really goes to show, reflects so well on KPCC developing such great talent. You know, in addition to you, Larry, you know, to have such great people working locally and then and getting that national recognition.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that very, very much. Are you planning to get out of town for this Memorial Day weekend?
You know, we're not planning on leaving town this weekend. We are for the following weekend. We've got some plans to meet with friends in Big Sur, so that'll be fun. But we are planning on seeing friends, vaccinated friends, unmasked for several events this weekend. We're going to Napa for a weekend to celebrate a friend's anniversary. We're having a martini party tomorrow night in the backyard of a neighbor, and we're having some friends over for dinner. So we do have some good plans this weekend.
That sounds great. What sort of advice do you have people who are hitting the road or taking to the skies to travel for this weekend? AAA is saying that travel by car is going to be around 60% higher than last year. I wouldn't be surprised if it goes up higher than that. And also airports preparing for a huge jump in air travel.
Well, you know, if you're vaccinated, everything is just so much easier. So if you're vaccinated, you're protected. The main danger to now is to people who are not vaccinated. You know, if you're vaccinated, you still may get breakthrough infection, but you're very unlikely to have a severe infection. It's likely to be asymptomatic or very mild. So those who are unvaccinated need to continue to take precautions, continue to mask, continue to social distance. And then even being on an airplane, even with masks on, is still somewhat risky for those who are unvaccinated, just because you can't social distance and people do take their masks off for, you know, for eating and drinking.
One thing to keep in mind also is remember that restaurant capacity is still lower until June 15th. I was looking at making reservations at some restaurants over the weekend. I'll be in town. But we wanted to go out and enjoy some outdoor dining. And reservations can be tough to come by. So just a warning to you if you're planning to do that. And Dr. Blumberg, you know, it's a great sign that restaurants are very, very busy. But of course, they're still dealing with those capacity limits, which makes it tougher on them.
It does make it tougher on them, and I think that's really good advice that a lot of places you're going to need to have reservations, and walk-ins are just not going to be accepted because they're going to be full with reservations. So, yeah, you got to plan ahead these days.
Yeah, no question. 866-893-KPECC. And again, come June 15th, those capacity limits go away and restaurants can seat what's been their typical full capacity if they have the staff to serve the full capacity. Now, that's the challenge that some restaurants are having, is being able to hire enough servers, back of the house people to be able to deal with a full house. So we'll see what happens there. We're at 866-893-KPECC. If you have questions for our medical authority today, UC Davis Children's Hospital, Dr. Dean Blumberg, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Dr. Blumberg, I was struck by a fascinating study which looked at not a huge number, but some people who had mild COVID-19 infections. And based on what they saw from the bone marrow of those individuals studied, it looks like the protection from future COVID-19 can be quite persistent.
Yeah, that was a study that looked not only at antibodies, but also looked at cellular immunity. So there's two main kinds of immunity that we develop after immunization or infection. The easy one to measure is the antibody production. The one that's more challenging to measure is called cell-mediated immunity. And it may be even more correlating with protection. So it's always good to measure, and especially with many viruses, it's the main thing that does protect against infection. So that did look very promising, and we're still really waiting. We're just in the dark about knowing whether we're going to need boosters or not. We've heard a lot of talk about that, but boy, it would be nice to know that.
Yeah, and again, looking at the variants that we've had, particularly in Brazil and India, the UK variant, which has become so common here in the United States, we're still seeing strong coverage by the current vaccines against those variants?
Yeah, it appears that our current vaccines protect very well against the UK variant. Maybe a modest decrease in efficacy, maybe from like 95% to 85%, but still good protection. The same with the Indian variants. The ones with the South African and the Brazilian variants, there's less information. There's some protection from those, but we really don't have a good handle about how much protection.
All right. Sam and Covina, related to what I was just bringing up about this limited study, is wondering, since he had had COVID last year, does that mean he can go without a vaccine? Would he still be protected? Could he use, for example, you know, a study like this in lieu of showing that he's fully vaccinated? I'm not sure they'd accept that, Sam, but what would you say to someone who previously had COVID in terms of immunity?
Well, we just don't know. You know, it's a promising study, but we know with other routine coronaviruses that cause the common cold, we know that protection generally only lasts 3 or 4 months. Now, COVID causes a more severe infection, so you might expect a stronger immune response and protection for longer than that. However, we do know that the immune responses following immunization are equivalent to or better than the immune responses following infection. So the safest thing to do is to be immunized, even if you've been infected. You'll likely have better protection after immunization.
Dan in the West Adams District of L.A. says if the Indian variant is much more infectious, does that mean counties with poor vaccination rates could see increases in cases?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the danger, is that we know the infection rate with the past strains. We know that the UK strain is about 50% more transmissible compared to previous strains. And what we've heard is that the Indian strains are about 20% more transmissible than the UK strains. And so certainly if there is a large group of susceptible people, such as a large county that has a poor vaccination rate, then you know, these new variants could go through the population like wildfire.
We have seen a smaller gap between racial and ethnic groups here in California as to who's getting vaccinated. There still is a gap that exists. Looking at urban versus rural, some of the numbers I've looked at, it looks like the gap is even bigger there. And I know some of that can be accessibility to the vaccine, but probably a significant part of that, too, is resistance to being vaccinated. So what does the future hold when you've got those kinds of differences?
Yeah, so I think you've pointed out the two main challenges. And so one is accessibility, and that hopefully will change with rejiggering the manufacturing of the vaccines. Because right now they're distributed in multi-dose vials, and so it's really not feasible to be administered in physician offices without having a lot of wastage, because once you go into that vial, you want to use it up. The storage requirements are easing, so that'll make it easier to distribute the vaccine to more rural areas so that they can store them appropriately. And then the other issue is the vaccine hesitancy, which has likely increased in more rural areas. And I'm glad to see that we're having more public health messaging to address vaccine hesitancy. And we normally have this public health messaging with new public health initiatives, and it was just lagging behind a bit, because normally we take the lead from the CDC, and then the CDC messages are adapted by the state and local public health, and that's happening now.
I know that with the early distribution of the vaccine, that, you know, going door-to-door mobile vaccination wasn't the most effective way to get the most people vaccinated early on. But now that we're seeing so many fewer people show up at vaccination sites, are we at the point where we can really gear up to go out door-to-door, go into communities where you've got homebound individuals or people that maybe you could have one-on-one conversations and encourage them to take the vaccine that's right there on site on their street?
Yeah, it's perfectly appropriate to shift public health resources from these large vaccination clinics than to try to reach the harder to reach populations. And so I think, you know, depending on public health resources locally, that's a perfectly appropriate thing to do in order to get people protected.
All right. Nancy in North Hollywood says, I wonder about the Novavax vaccine. For those who don't want an mRNA vaccine, what do we know about Novavax and what its clinical trials are showing?
Yeah, so the clinical trials, are, at least the initial part of the clinical trials, are mostly complete in adults. We're doing a Novavax vaccine trial in children 12 to 17 years of age. What I've heard from public statements from Novavax is that they expect to file with the FDA for emergency use authorization in the third quarter of this year. I don't know why there was a delay, because initially they said they were going to file sometime in April. So there's some sort of delay, but hopefully the data looks solid as far as I've seen. It has at least 85% protection, and it is more of a traditional protein-based vaccine. So it's different than the mRNA vaccine or the DNA Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
866-893-KPECC, UC Davis, Professor of Medicine, Dr. Dean Blumberg, joining us on Air Talk. He's the Chief of Pediatric Infectious Diseases at UC Davis Children's Hospital in Sacramento. 866-893-KPECC. We have in Redondo Beach, Jennifer, who asks, do children still need to wear masks indoors, especially come June 15th? If so, what's the science behind infection rates in children being so low?
Yeah, so the children are less likely to get infected than adults, and when they're infected, they're less likely to have severe infection. However, thousands of children have been hospitalized with COVID nationwide, and hundreds of children have died from COVID. I personally have seen children in the ICU, on ventilators, intubated, very sick with COVID, and I've seen children with the post-infectious syndrome, the MISC, the multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children, who've been very sick in the ICU. So children can still get very sick, and if they're not vaccinated, they're susceptible, and that's who's getting infected these days, is those who are susceptible. So children absolutely should continue to mask. Any child over 2 years of age should continue to mask while they're around other people if they're not able to social distance.
We welcome your questions for Dr. Dean Blumberg, UC Davis Medical. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. In case you just joined us, we have wonderful news about our own A. Martinez of Take Two joining the national broadcast of Morning Edition from the NPR West studios in Culver City beginning in the month of July. He starts at NPR in early July, and a date for his first on-air hosting of Morning Edition will soon be forthcoming. And we hope that A will be able to continue on the triple play here on Air Talk along with our Nick Roman. So we'll see as he gets settled in July at NPR. You're listening to Air Talk on KPECC. We'll be back with Dr. Blumberg in just 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC, the KPECC smartphone app in which you can take us around the world. More people presumably will be doing that as we move deeper into 2021. And of course, you can stream everywhere, kpecc.org. We're talking with Dr. Dean Blumberg, UC Davis Children's Hospital. He's professor of medicine, UC Davis, and chief of pediatric infectious diseases at the Sacramento located Children's Hospital. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. We have Edmund in Glendale who says he got his first shot of Moderna, wondering if he can have his second shot earlier. He doesn't say why. I assume it's some sort of a scheduling issue. Perhaps he's going to be traveling or something. Wondering if he can move it up to 3 weeks out for the Moderna instead of waiting the 4 that was studied.
Yeah, you know, the problem with doing that is it just hasn't been well studied, and so it makes it very difficult to know what the immune response is. What the CDC recommends in terms of scheduling is a variation of 4 days, a window of 4 days. So you could move it up to 4 weeks minus 4 days, and it would still count as a valid injection, and that's what was used in the studies in terms of counting. Validly immunized people.
Now, in the UK, in an effort to get more first doses into people, didn't they delay second doses? I don't know whether that was AstraZeneca or not. Didn't it actually show improved antibody response with the delay in getting the second dose?
Yeah, absolutely. So the problem with the issue with the vaccine schedule is you can't squeeze it and make it shorter and expect just as good immune response. But if you lengthen it, that's fine. The CDC does recommend getting the vaccines on schedule, but we know from other vaccines, other routinely administered vaccines, is if you delay the second dose, you get a better immune response compared to the shorter interval. So I don't worry about having delayed if somebody's like, instead of getting their second dose at 3 or 4 weeks, if they delay it a month, the CDC still accepts it. You do delay that boost in immunity. That's the danger of it, but you do end up with a better immune response.
And even the first shot gives, what, an 80-plus percent effectiveness rate from just one shot?
Exactly, and that's why the UK decided to prioritize first doses rather than doing it on schedule.
And that's 80-plus percent. It would seem to me when we had more COVID out in California than we have now.
Yeah, the mathematical modeling at that time suggested that they would prevent more infections and save more lives by getting more first doses in than completing the second doses. And so that's why they decided to do it that way.
So, Edmund, if you absolutely can't at the 4 week mark or within 4 days of the 4 week mark, get your second Moderna shot, perhaps going a little bit longer if it's a scheduling issue, might work out fine for you. Cecilia in Pacific Palisades says, I'm a physical therapist. I've treated some COVID long haulers. Many of them were asymptomatic for COVID and later got long haul symptoms. I'm wondering if breakthrough after vaccination is as likely to show long haul symptoms as unvaccinated asymptomatic people. How common is that for someone who's asymptomatic with COVID to end up then with symptoms later?
You know, we just don't know how common that is yet. We're still gathering that data. But we think that the reason that people get the long haul, that people get those persistent symptoms, is likely related to an aberrant immune response. And you're more likely to have an overexuberant immune response due to more severe infection. So it seems to me that it would be less likely after asymptomatic infection because there would be less of a robust immune response in that case.
Is it possible, and I don't mean to diminish the very serious symptoms long haulers have from COVID, is it possible in some of the cases that persistent anxiety related to COVID-19 and people knowing that they had tested positive for it, even if they were asymptomatic, that the stress of that could in some way be responsible for the symptoms?
I'm sure that may be true in some cases, but we think it's similar to like chronic fatigue syndrome, where you can actually measure immune responses that are different long after people have recovered. You get these persistent immune responses. Things are really out of whack. You can measure specific neurocognitive defects with neuropsychologic testing. So there's really objective findings that we have with that, and we're just beginning to understand it.
And is it important for people to get that diagnosis if they think that they're starting to get the symptoms of COVID long haul to see a doctor, to take those tests, to get those findings?
Well, my response is yes, but yes, a qualified yes, because a lot of doctors are not familiar with that, and they're not sure where to get the testing, which can be specialized. They're not sure how to approach it. There's still a lot of ignorance on the issue with everybody on this, so it's very difficult. We have a lot of difficulty with our children trying to find appropriate places to refer them for that. So it can be really challenging. There are some specific treatments that we know will work for some of the persistent symptoms, such as the loss of taste and smell and some of the other symptoms of cognition or altered sleep. We know there's specific therapies for that, but it's tough to get people in for treatment.
And do you know if there are people who've tested positive for COVID-19 but were asymptomatic and then weeks down the road lost their sense of taste and smell? Or is that pretty much only happening when someone has the active infection?
We think that also happens with asymptomatic infection. I mean, I'm personally aware of cases that has occurred, that patients, for example, have had antibodies So they haven't had acute infection. They never tested positive because they weren't tested with the swab test. They have loss of taste and smell, and then they have positive antibodies. And so it seems that they must have had infection, and that's likely the cause of that. So we think that it can occur with asymptomatic infection.
Jen of LA writes on our AirTalk page, I've only seen real-world effectiveness studies on the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines. How about Johnson & Johnson? As someone who got the J&J vaccine, I was hoping for a higher effectiveness in the real world since the trials were done at the height of the pandemic. Great question, Jen.
Yeah, you know, the problem with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is it's only a small percentage of the market, and so there's a lot less data with it compared to Pfizer and Moderna. Pfizer and Moderna have really been dominating the vaccine distribution, and part of that was the pause that was put on with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So we just don't have as much data, and I'm just looking at that data now that of the over almost 360 million doses that have been administered in the U.S., only 10 million of those doses have been Johnson & Johnson.
We have Larry in West L.A., a couple of questions. His first one, could there be a combination of mRNA vaccines, so a couple of different ones, in a booster shot so you'd get a cocktail? Would that potentially be a more effective booster?
Yeah, certainly what you could do is you could do, for example, have the mRNA encoding for spike proteins of different strains. So it could be a multivalent vaccine. So you could have the past strain, the UK strain, the Indian strain, all included in the same vaccine, just like we have for influenza vaccines, where we have a 3 or 4 valent vaccine. So certainly that is being studied.
Anna in South Pasadena asks, is it okay for children to be unmasked outdoors as we head into summer with the rate of infection so low with children? I'm wondering if it's okay for them to be outside unmasked.
Outdoor activities are always safer than the indoor activities. 90% of the transmission takes place indoors. When you're outdoors, there's much more dilution of the virus due to the much larger volume of air, and people are able to distance more. So certainly children, unless they're in very close contact, then if they're able to distance at all outdoors, then being unmasked is okay.
All right. We have Ellis in Hollywood. If my six-year-old contracts COVID-19, gets over the symptoms, what are the chances down the road that my six-year-old could end up with a respiratory illness linked to the COVID-19 infection years earlier?
Well, you can get COVID twice, and we still don't know about the immune response and the protection. We know that getting COVID within 3 months of illness is very rare, but after that, we just don't know if they could get it again. So it is possible.
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Heaven's Girl writes on the page, I got the first Pfizer shot. I had an allergic reaction. My doctor told me not to get the second one. I caught COVID a few weeks ago, was given monoclonal antibodies. I have no idea what to do at this point, and I don't have confidence that my doctors do either. I'm asthmatic and in treatment for breast cancer. All of this is quite concerning. What would you advise?
Yeah, that is concerning. So obviously, if you did have a severe allergic reaction to any ingredient in the vaccine, then it wouldn't be recommended. And you're at high risk for getting severe COVID due to underlying illness. So, yeah, I'd be concerned too. The monoclonal antibodies will protect for some time, probably for about 90 days. So you do have some time after that. There's partial protection from that first dose. And, of course, there's protection from being infected and the immune response from that. But you may need doses in the future, and there may be new vaccines against the new strains that you need to be protected against. So what I've been recommending in those circumstances is asking your doctor for a referral to an allergist. The allergists are really the best place to decide about significant allergies that would be contraindications to future vaccination.
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We should mention the first man to get a COVID-19 vaccine. Bill Shakespeare, wonderful that they chose a man of that name to get the first vaccine. He died at the age of 81. He died of a stroke in the UK. People have put headlines, first person to get COVID-19 vaccine dies. Of course, he was 81 years of age. But it brings to mind sort of the kinds of news coverage that deaths of people or illness of people who've had COVID-19, who've had the vaccine, have received. There is a kind of almost misdirection in those headlines. And I wonder if you could speak to the point that, people get sick of totally other things or die of totally unrelated causes after getting a COVID-19 vaccine.
Yeah, I mean, COVID, the vaccine's not gonna prevent death from other causes. So we know.
If only.
Yeah, so people are going to die after getting vaccinated. And some people, a very small percent, will get COVID. They're going to get breakthrough infections. And although the vaccines protect even better against severe illness and death than they do against mild infections, I would fully expect that, it's not going to protect 100%. So some people are going to have breakthrough infections and die also. But it's abundantly clear that getting vaccinated is very, very effective at preventing all infections, and it's clearly the safest thing to do at the present time.
And I'm awaiting that vaccine that prevents against death. I think that'll be very popular once that's developed. Jim and Tarzana said, I went to get a replacement vaccination record card from Kaiser. They told me to print out my medical record. I just lost that comment. I don't have a record with me. Is there some place that I can get a replacement in case I want to go to a ball game or something like that and need to show I've been fully vaccinated?
Yeah, well, Kaiser keeps wonderful records. So, I think requesting that from Kaiser is your first step. The state also has a record because Kaiser reports to the state. If you sign the waiver when you got immunized, then they will also report to the state immunization registry. And I'm personally not familiar with getting records from that, but they should also be able to get it from that. I took a picture of mine so I would have it, and then I put it in a very secure place. And the other day I was looking for it, and I couldn't find it. I'm embarrassed to say I put it in such a secure place that it's secure from me. So I fully understand losing your vaccine record.
Yeah, I hate that. Glenn in Playa del Rey, we were scheduled to get my 12-year-old vaccinated last Sunday, but we canceled after waking up to an NPR story about problems with myocarditis in children who had been vaccinated. What do you think about that? Is that a risk that would counteract the importance of my 12-year-old being vaccinated?
Yeah, I saw that too. And you can go online to the CDC website, and they have been reviewing the reports. Of course, reports of anything concerning after immunization, we encourage doctors and others to submit those reports. What they found was a relatively few reports of myocarditis, and they seem to occur predominantly in adolescents and young adults, more often in males than females, and more often following dose 2 than dose 1, and typically within 4 days after vaccination. But most cases appear to be mild. They're still following up these cases. They still felt that the information about myocarditis is important to be transparent about, but that immunization, still the risk of myocarditis is extraordinarily low, and the benefits of vaccination far outweigh that risk. So we're still recommending vaccination.
Dr. Blumberg, such a pleasure to talk with you again, sir. Thanks. Have a terrific, sounds like very busy social weekend with your friends and neighbors, and we'll look forward to talking with you again, hopefully next week.
Thanks, Larry. Have a nice weekend yourself.
Thank you. Dr. Dean Blumberg, UC Davis Children's Hospital, where he's chief of pediatric infectious diseases. He's also professor of medicine at UC Davis Medical. Coming up, we'll talk about this Memorial Day weekend, the traditional start of summer travel, all the revelry that goes into the changing as we move into the summer and people taking time off from work. Of course, everything's been different over the past 15 plus months. We'll talk about what we expect in the way of travel this weekend, and I want to hear from you. What are you planning to do in the way of travel this weekend that you haven't done in more than a year? 866-893-KPECC. And what allowances are you making for COVID-19 and safe travel? 866-893-5722. It's a chance for you to give and get advice. We'll be back in just 90 seconds on Air Talk.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.